Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Season 5 of Electric Boogaloo, you may be interested to know, will have a couple running themes. The first is that I've been digging deep into historical precedents for trial by combat. It seems that most examples of trial by battle were used for civil disputes. But of course, Tyrion gets into trouble here for really what we would consider a crime against the state, or a crime against the king, and historical precedents for what we consider a criminal case are not so easy to come by. So I've been doing a lot of reading, I've been talking to experts on this, and my interview with Ian McGinnis was my first attempt at trying to flesh out historical examples. Ian is senior lecturer at the Center for History at the University of the Highlands and Islands in Scotland. The second running theme this season will be knights and chivalry, and we'll talk a little bit about that with my second guest, and that is Curtis Runstedtler. Curtis is currently lecturing in Germany at the University of Tübingen. So we're kind of all over Europe this week. Curtis and I will be covering Catelyn's 7th POV chapter. This is the famous trial by combat between Sir Vardis Egan and Bronn the Freerider. But before we get to that, here is my short interview with Ian McGinnis. Yeah, all right. So Ian McGinnis, and then, of course, the title of the book?
Is Scotland's Second War of Independence, 1332 to 1357.
Oh, damn. That's just the classic history title right there.
You have to keep it simple.
Even have the dates. Oh, well done, sir. My first monograph, check this out. This is how stupid I was. I put the word historiographical in the title.
That way, dangerous.
What was I thinking? Historiographical. Anyway, that was, you know, the blunders of young men, I suppose.
Yes, I did have a longer title to start with, but my editor kind of bashed me over the head several times and told me to make it simpler.
What do you think about the Harry Potter and the Second War of Scotland? That would be fantastic.
I do that with my article titles instead, and try to come up with something suitably random that people will come up with and insert.
Yeah. I have a question for you, and it's sort of I'm springing this on you. I didn't give you any notice on this question, Ian. Are you game? Are you game for taking an impromptu question?
Whether I can answer or not, I can't promise, but I'll do my best.
Okay. All right, so Tyrion has chosen trial by combat. And this seems an invention in Martin's world, and it's got this theological component, like, the gods will decide whether you're innocent, you know, and there are the rules about whether or not you can choose a champion or not or whatever. So this is a very sort of World of Ice and Fire specific. But are there any historical inspirations that might have given Martin this particular idea?
I mean, I suppose that that's quite a current question due to the film that's just coming out or just out, Ridley Scott's new film, the last Duel.
The Last Duel, yes, of course. Yeah. Of course, you know, duels, a lot of famous duels in history, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that would just be like you and me have a problem and we go out in the field and settle it. There's no theological or justice component, is there?
Well, no, I think it still is. I mean, there is, it's that ultimate decision that as you said, it's God's judgment. It comes down to the two individuals fighting it out, and it ultimately is God's judgment. I mean, it's the same logic that's used about medieval battles. You know, both sides go into a medieval battle thinking that they have right on their side, but it's ultimately it's God's judgment as to who wins and who loses, and that's how such things are written about. So, I mean, there is a legalistic component to the kind of trial by battle idea, and I think all men accused of a crime have, depending on place and time, but often have recourse to various different ways to prove their innocence within legal structures. And one of those is, you know, the recourse to trial by battle. And it does happen, I think, in various cases where yes, it's ultimately the strength of your hand that proves your innocence as opposed to anything else.
So, yeah, so you're saying that there are historical precedents for someone who has been accused of a crime who, instead of, you know, deciding to use their words to defend themselves, decide to use their hands and their metal to defend themselves.
Yeah, I think it's often in cases where perhaps, because one of the alternatives is that you have, you know, you bring out a coterie of individuals who will back you up, who will effectively provide evidence to say that yes or no, you didn't do this. And perhaps in circumstances where that isn't possible, then this is an alternative. There is a kind of oft-quoted case, and I can't remember the exact details of it, of a trial by combat, though, where the victor, in fact, the man who, he manages to slay the opponent, but the opponent falls on him and kind of pins him to the ground, and he ends up pinned by the dead body of the man he's run through, and because he can't get up, he's effectively then declared the loser, and so loses the case.
I think I once saw that with the Macho Man Randy Savage and Andre the Giant. Was that the case you were thinking of?
No, not the specific one. No, I think this was a medieval example. But
All right. Continue. Sorry.
No. But I think I know there are a couple of, you know, from my own research, there are a couple of Scottish examples.
Just a quick insert here. After this conversation, Ian emailed me and wrote this. 28 October 1354, William de Heron was given permission to fight a duel in Scotland. The duel was supposed to take place in front of William de Buchan against John Waylace and William Prudhomme because they were accused of having stolen Heron's horses, for which he demanded justice through combat. So thanks to Ian, we have a specific example. And now back to my conversation with Ian McGuinness.
I think ultimately, kind of recourse to trial by combat is an option, but isn't necessarily always one that's sought. I think I suppose the only comparison I could make is with examples in battles, and again, you have those cases where you have individual challenges offered before a battle starts, and you even have examples in the Hundred Years' War, where someone will you know, a King of England will suggest that, well, we don't need to have this battle and have thousands of men die. Right, we can sort this out amongst ourselves, and that's played up in The King, that Netflix film that was done a couple of years ago with Timothy Chalamet, and that idea of instead of fighting the Battle of Agincourt, that the kings could sort out themselves beforehand. But you do have challenges offered, and you do have these one-on-one combats before the full-scale thing starts. And again, I think it's an expansion of the same idea of that individual prowess. And obviously, there's links here to the tournament and to more frivolous pastimes as well as, you know, entertainment and skills training. But there is that legalistic aspect of it as well. I'm not necessarily sure if it's as necessarily as common as all that, but it is a recourse. And equally, you know, throughout the series, we see highborn knights, men of good family, behaving abysmally. And I think that Martin has a very negative idea of chivalry as a concept and of the knighthood as a class. And I think someone like Bronn is almost like the kind of, he's not the corrective to it, but Bronn has his own code, arguably, that he fights by. And it's more simplistic. It's not tied up in quasi-religious ideas and structures, but he sticks to it nonetheless, by and large. And I think that works for him.
Yeah, Vardis Egan is very much sort of this, sort of the epitome of the knight, not just in terms of being a warrior, a professional warrior, but also by way of courtesy and, you know, the whole religious ritual aspect of it. Whereas Bronn is portrayed as a killer. You know, he's a murdering, bastard. So let's talk a little bit about that distinction.
Yeah. It's interesting, in the TV version, in the trial by combat, you get that notion, the way it's depicted, that there's those suggestions of, oh, you know, he's not fighting properly, he's not fighting like a knight, and that's how Bronn ends up winning. But Bronn is fighting in a way that he knows ultimately will prove, well, he hopes will ultimately be successful. He fights in a way that's clever, that's sensible. He's not burdened by any notions of respectability about how he should fight, and arguably then he's more successful because of it. And then we get into that whole thing of, you know, what is a warrior and what isn't, what is a knight and what isn't, and where exactly does Bronn sit within that warrior society of Westeros?
Mm-hmm. Clearly, knights are killers, and if you were to talk to someone like the Hound, he would say, "Yeah, of course, that's it. That's all they really are. They're killers." Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, the rules of the day would suggest otherwise. Like, knights are much more than that. In fact, this is something of a noble calling. So what is sort of the difference between someone like Bronn and someone like Vardis Egan?
I think Egan probably represents the kind of knightly chivalric ideal. He represents the vision of the warrior that, you know, Sansa reads about in her romances that she's obsessed by, and those fantastical stories about knights defending their ladies. And then that's exactly what Vardis Egan is called upon to do and does do. Although obviously with the likelihood of marrying Lysa at some point down the line. And I think it's the ideal of knighthood that we see in medieval romance, as well as in the romances that are depicted in the show and in the novels. But then you have warriors like Bronn who are rather different. And that what you said about the comparison with the Hound is quite a useful one. I think someone like the Hound is kind of like the voice of reality, the voice of practicality. He's far more black and white about recognizing how knights behave. And as you say, knights are killers as well. It is how they go about it and how they portray themselves that's perhaps the distinction, as well as where they come from. But I think there's far less between someone like Clegane and Sandor Clegane and Bronn than there is between the Hound and various of the other knights you see.
Okay, well that's very helpful. I'm glad that you were able to do that on the fly, because I was thinking, like, you know what, I really need to address that because it didn't get addressed before.
Tyrion ends up in this position again, doesn't he? Where he's supposed to fight the Mountain, and it's the Prince of Dorne who fights for him instead. And
right,
and that one doesn't work out for him that time. So
that one doesn't work out for anyone, really.
Well, no, not very true. It doesn't work out for the Mountain either.
Dr. McGinnis will be back in a couple weeks to help me cover the next Tyrion chapter. And now to cover Catelyn's 8th POV chapter with me, here's Dr. Curtis Runstetler. Curtis Runstetler, tell me everything I need to know about medieval robots.
Medieval robots, where to begin? So I look at kind of depictions. Robot is more of a 20th century word, so I use kind of robots and automata interchangeably too. Yeah. But I look at examples such as talking brazen heads, and I'm also looking at alchemical homunculus too, basically like a test tube baby in the Middle Ages and Renaissance.
Yeah, so for someone who's never connected it with this literature at all before, So an automaton was this thing that was crafted out of metal to make it look like it was self-animated, but in reality, there was like someone inside it or some sort of strings being pulled or something. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. Like a lot of times in the medieval Arabic world, or then in the Persian world too, it'd be more like mechanisms. You'd kind of push a button or pull a wheel or something, and you'd have kind of like this. A lot of times they'd have these bleeding, well, they called them bleeding statues, but they were just statues that just had water inside them.
Sure.
Kind of like an apparatus. But yeah, a lot of times there was kind of an extra step to them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm looking at their place within medieval literature too. A lot of times they're kind of beyond the peripheries of what is considered natural and supernatural. So they're really kind of interesting in terms of liminal spaces. A lot of times these automata are kind of too dangerous to exist, but they also anticipate modern concerns with technology, because I think even now a lot of people are afraid of kind of being replaced or not sure where technology fits in within their lives too. So I'm really interested in those kind of questions.
And correct me if I'm wrong, sometimes people thought that they were animated by like a demon or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a lot of fears that these technologies, what kind of inhabits the soul of this creation, you know, is it demonic? Is it something preternatural? So that's kind of an ongoing debate. My previous research looked at medieval alchemy too. So there's a lot of interesting crossovers there just in terms of, yeah, you know, like the legitimacy of alchemy. Should we practice it, or is it kind of demonic by nature? And, you know, are we kind of transcending God's ways by, you know, practicing, you know, creating these homunculi? So,
well, let me ask you this, like, so sort of ease into Game of Thrones here. So I'm curious if you would see a parallel here with what Qyburn is doing with the mountain.
I would say that. Yeah, definitely. There's some kind of alchemical practice, because he is considered a practicing alchemist too, and the maesters always practice these in Qyburn's case, it's kind of these sketchy experiments. So there's a little bit of kind of because we don't really see him die, right? So we don't know if it's really necromancy or whether it's this kind of alchemical experiments. Alchemy is a little bit twisted in Game of Thrones because it's almost more like pyromancy too. They say they don't even pretend to transmute the metals, but they have this amazing kind of capabilities with making this wildfire. Although to what extent, you know, it fits the kind of medieval or classical definition of alchemy is kind of up for debate. I guess you could say Qyburn's kind of like a jack of all trades in some ways with all of his esoteric knowledge and interest in the occult.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly the suspicions of him would sort of have a parallel with the suspicions that surrounded these people that were working in, I don't know, either preternatural or demonic or supernatural or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Well, today, Curtis, we're looking at Catlin's eighth POV chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So famously, this is the chapter where Bronn stands in for Tyrion in a trial by combat.
It feels, in some ways, you know, when they do have that kind of battle too, it feels so unfair when you watch it, you know, because here we have this valiant kind of glamorous knight and we have this kind of asshole sellsword Bronn.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then he kind of just does all the dirty tricks in the book too. So, I mean, you know, on a metaphorical level, like chivalry is literally dead. We have this kind of fanciful display of chivalry, but it's to his disadvantage too.
Yeah.
He has this beautiful shining armor and then, you know, it weighs him down, and then Bronn just kind of knows how to manipulate that and wins the battle. And it's great because we all love Tyrion, but I mean, it sucks for and that's also, I think, George R. R. Martin's kind of stab at chivalry too. So he's always kind of taking stabs at chivalry, at the kind of performativity of it.
We really see sort of a contrast between someone like, he's not just a trained knight, he's a man of court, you know, he's
absolutely,
he's high society,
he's
elite.
Very respectable. Yeah, he's very respectable.
So he's so it's a contrast between a respectable knight and just a low-born killer. That's what Bronn is. He's just a killer. And of course, in Martin's world, the killer is going to win, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you come to the Eyrie and you think it's going to be like this kind of, you know, great little lord, but he's very sickly and kind of insufferable, isn't he? Robert, the little boy, too. So, I mean,
absolutely.
In a way, I was kind of glad. I was like, oh, you know, don't give him everything he wants, you know?
I absolutely want to get into that. Let me read my synopsis of the chapter. Cat looks upon a waterfall named Alyssa's Tears and admires the beauty of the dawn, but she has a bad feeling about what the day will bring. Roderick has brought her news that portends to war, and she cannot trust her sister to deal wisely with the imp. This is confirmed by the Blackfish, who complains that Lysa has refused him 1,000 swords to go defend Riverrun. Kat invites her uncle to Winterfell and promises him the men he needs. Kat tries to talk her sister out of the scheduled trial by combat, to no avail. After a few ceremonial gestures in the garden, the fighters are in place, Ser Vardis Egan representing Lysa and Bronn the Freerider who represents Tyrion. Bronn dodges and dances around Vardis to tire the older man, then Bronn wounds the knight at his elbow joint. Once the knight is reduced, Bronn pushes a large garden statue onto his opponent and traps him before killing him. Lysa reluctantly allows Tyrion to leave by way of the high road rather than the moon door. So, Curtis Runsettler, what do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I'm feeling the ladder of chaos.
All right, so chaos it is. Mm-hmm. You go first.
So I think there's so much to talk about with this chapter, which is great.
I know.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the chivalry already. I want to talk about Lysa Arryn, actually, because I think she's such a fascinating character, and she really represents this, the insanity of I think it's very much a reaction to the kind of world that she's into. You know, she's been married to this, Jon Arryn was great as the Hand, but he was a terrible husband, you know, and she's had to live with this for years. You know, she's always been kind of subordinated and put in second place. And you really see that kind of insanity come more and more to the fore, too. We know what, you know, she's actually been up to with Littlefinger, too, which started the whole books. And for all of Jon Arryn's kind of he's such a significant character, but we don't really get to know him in the books, which is interesting because it starts just as he's died. So I mean, it would have been kind of interesting to have him in the books too.
Interesting that you say that she's insane. I had another guest who said she's kind of portrayed that way in the show, but in the book, is she insane or is she conniving? You know, she sort of plot. Mm. Is she plotting and scheming? Maybe she's not as insane. But and
that's
the other thing
point,
that you said was that Jon Arryn wasn't a great husband, and I'm curious to hear you talk about those two things.
I think it might be because coming from what she has kind of said about it too. Because you know, by all other accounts, I think he was a good husband. But I mean, the way that he's described, she said, you know, his breath smelled really bad, and he was very old, and I think she was quite a young woman when she was married to him. I think.
Probably a loveless marriage, right?
It kind of reminded me that the fisherman's tale, the shipman's tale, the Chaucer tale, where the kind of really old man has this very young wife too, and they're just kind of incongruous together, you know? So
yeah, I want to read this one little passage about Lysa. This is sort of this is Kat's impression of her sister.
Yes,
the shy girl she had known at Riverrun had grown into a woman who is by turns proud, fearful, cruel, dreamy, reckless, timid, stubborn, vain, and above all, inconstant. So, I mean, I guess if she's sort of vacillating in between all of these different aspects, I guess that could sort of display as insane. But Kat's idea of her, I mean, proud, fearful, cruel, dreamy, reckless, timid, stubborn, vain, and above all, inconstant. The word insane is not used, and yet maybe when you put all those together, that's kind of how it strikes you.
I think what is clear is there's a transformation. So maybe I'm reading into it too much by saying insanity. But I mean, we are seeing it from Kat's point of view. Yeah, I mean, I think what is clear is there's a transformation in her character. She's not the girl that she knew in Riverrun, and she's been very, very different. So whether it's on account of just being alone for so long or just being feeling neglected or whatever the case may be, I mean, she has kind of changed. And as we see, it's not necessarily for better. It's, you know, probably
like
for
maybe
worse.
Not, maybe not insane. Maybe like, I mean, you could just say crazy. She's crazy. I mean, that, even if it's not sort of a technical term, that's how she will present. The other thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit was Robert Arryn.
Yes.
And I might just call him Robin. And he's in
little
the chapter,
Robin,
he's called Robert, but it, you know, too many Robins, right? So if I call him
Robin, that's why. Sweet Robin,
Sweet Robin. I felt like reading this chapter, I felt like this whole thing is a rehearsal for Joffrey. You know, you have this immature, bloodthirsty asshole of a kid who just
make the man fly.
he wants the men to fight. He wants to make the man fly. He's totally
he's very detached from the meaning of human life. He just has no, his callous disregard for human life. You know,
yeah, he's been spoiled. He really had, yeah, you're right. He's out of touch with what we might call empathy. And you can kind of see how things can run amok really quickly with someone like that, who's sort of the Lord of the Veil. And then, of course, this is lower stakes, but we're going to find out eventually how this will work for the entire kingdom when the king has all of these qualities.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of sad to think about John Arryn, because he gave so much to the realm. And then, you know, when you think about his legacy, he has this Lys Arryn and then this awful Sweet Robin, you know? After everything John Arryn did, I mean, just, there's just not much to show for it, is there? Mm-hmm. You know?
I was thinking that the other thing that struck me about this particular chapter was that when the trial by combat is all ramping up, Kat's mind is cast back to this previous combat between Brandon and Peter Baelish. Peter Baelish at that point being a little more than a boy. And it almost makes me think, so there's sort of a combat within a combat in this chapter, and it almost made me think these things are related, because I think that maybe Baelish's origin story is that combat. You know, he makes a play for the woman he loves, is rejected and humiliated, and maimed.
And then he holds on to that. Yeah. I think also it's interesting in terms of the wounds, because we have this obviously very graphic physical wound. You know, he almost kills him with the final blow. But he also seems to internalize these wounds too. You know, like, we don't know to what extent, but I think he has kind of metaphorical and physical wounds, and also kind of the wounds of being on this lower social class, being inadequate for marriage to Catelyn and that sort of thing as well.
Right. And those internal wounds are motivators for him. I mean, he has set this whole thing in motion, this relationship with Lysa, the letter to Kat that ultimately brings Ned south, the attempted murder on Bran. All of that stuff is flowing from this origin story with Peter Baelish, where he's trying to sow chaos in the kingdom because of the chaos within him, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I thought it was a fascinating way to couch that origin story between Brandon and Peter Baelish.
And I was thinking about his sigil, too, with the Mockingbird there, too. I mean, he's kind of like, in his position of power, he's kind of mocking all those who kind of fucked him over.
Yes, so, that's right.
Yeah.
And so, right. And if you think about the story between, you know, the young upstart Baelish, who's no match for the hulking Brandon Stark. But of course, Baelish loses that battle, but he's going to go try to win the war. Eventually, Brandon dies, and Peter Baelish survives, and he survives long enough to ruin the entire kingdom.
Yeah, because you're like a king among the ashes kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm curious, Curtis, you know, you're a studied medievalist, and I'm wondering, what are you noticing about this particular chapter that those of us who are not studied medievalists maybe didn't see?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting at the beginning with that scene with Eliza's tears, because it almost reminds me of the Chaucer's Troilus and Crusade, the Obad. So we have this beautiful sunrise, and we have this beautiful dawn sequence where Catelyn's kind of watching the dawn break over the Eyrie. And I thought what was interesting here is that usually the Obad kind of signifies something, you know, two lovers waking up in the morning together or something kind of beautiful happening. But here it's a little bit ironic, too, because we have this beautiful sunrise, and then we have this kind of very naughty kind of trial by combat. Again, it's Martin, I think, kind of satirizing, I guess, the Abad tradition in the medieval world a little bit too. You know, it's not this romantic happening, but it's actually this kind of unromantic kind of reality.
Yeah.
What's intriguing, I think, is that, you know, there is kind of a sense of honor and tradition here. It's kind of a little bit controversial, I think, that a sellsword fights this kind of really powerful knight too, but I think this is kind of a exceptional situation.
Sure. And in reality, we know as readers that the reason why Bronn wins is because Ser Vardis Egan has everything going against him.
I think what's interesting too, in terms of like his loss, like Vardis's loss is also, you know, like, it just shows how impractical the armor is. because a lot of times we see these kind of, you know, Ivanhoe, for instance, too, we have that kind of Victorian image of the medieval. But, you know, when we actually have that suit of armor on it, I mean, it's really heavy. Maybe if the guy had worn less armor or just not been as honorable as a fighter, you know, the honor that kind of gets you killed. We see that too in the when they have the Feast for Robert and they have that little tournament. And, yeah. You know, things go wild. And then the mountain kind of kills his horse too. Like, it's literally like a death of chivalry, the cheval from the French. But yeah, that's something to kind of keep in mind too.
So I made a chart. All right. There's nothing more nerdy than making a chart and then getting charts excited about getting someone else to listen to your chart. But anyway, here's my chart.
Yeah.
So it's the contrast between Vardis and Braun. Okay. So. Mm-hmm. Vardis is sort of gleaming head to toe, and Braun is unshaven. You get the sense that, like, here's Vardis. He's polished. He's polished for the occasion, and Braun didn't even take the time to shave.
Yeah, he's all dolled up.
Vardis has a shield. Braun has no shield. The swords. So Catelyn says the sword functions as Braun's own arm. The sword is so a part of Braun, it's like his own arm, whereas with Vardis, it's not even his own sword. It's this decorative silver sword that Lysa had created for her husband, and she thinks it'll be like symbolic. This is not.
Yeah, the non-existent ghosts are going to come out of nowhere and save his ass.
Right. So then finally, Vardis needs his squire to help him stand after he kneels for the Septon because he's older and his armor is like head to toe. It's probably weighing him down. And then, of course, it says that Braun moves like a panther and he's quick as a cat. So you're right. All of this sort of tradition that's viewed as chivalrous and honorable is really weighing Vardis down. And, of course, Braun knows how to take advantage of this.
Absolutely.
So Braun is almost like an animal in this. You know, he's described as a panther and a cat. But he really is sort of this almost subhuman creature that Tyrion decides that he can use to his benefit.
Absolutely. He's very good at surviving. And it's interesting how for part of it, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it a symbiosis, how like his relationship with Tyrion is always kind of fascinating. You know, they're just kind of using each other. It's not really a friendship. It's just a, you know, playing the Game of Thrones, I guess.
We should also note this myth of Elysa and her tears at the beginning. And there's this big statue of Elysa in the garden. Braun uses the mythology against the people of the Vale. You know, he takes this big statue and pushes it over and crushes Vardis Egan. So just sort of symbolically, Braun has decided to use the mythology that makes the Vale, you know, grand and use it against them. You know, to kind
yeah,
of
literally, yeah,
really push over. It reminds you a little bit of like first century cynics who would like defile statues or whatever, just to kind of show how empty the tradition is.
Yeah, absolutely. They have like a practical value, but then they shatter as soon as they hit the ground. So it doesn't really serve much purpose otherwise, you know.
So eventually what ends up happening is because Braun wins, Lysa sends Tyrion along the high road. And Kat realizes, like, oh, this is actually a shrewd move, because even though Tyrion seems to have gone free, leaving by the high road without an army is really kind of a perilous, it's almost a death sentence in itself. So even though Tyrion doesn't leave by way of the Moondor, leaving by way of the high road is a different kind of death. And so
absolutely.
I think that Lysa thinks that she wins either way. Some notable introductions in this chapter. Eon Hunter is mentioned. Sir Lynn is mentioned. And then, of course, this myth and statue of Elysa. So notable differences. The Blackfish is not at all in this episode in the show. And you see that he's keenly interested in River Run. You know, he's like, look, I may be a Blackfish, but I'm still a Tully, and I'm going to go defend River Run, even if my niece won't give me 1,000 swords that I need. So you have that whole plot that's not in the show. Also different in the book is that, you know, they don't do the trial by combat in the, you know, the actual throne room.
You don't fight with honor.
No. He did.
Which, of course, you would never do. You would never do that in the throne room, right?
No, absolutely not. That'd be,
So they move it to, you know, they move it outside, of course, but it's sort of uneven ground. And then, of course, you don't have the statue crushing Vardis Egan in the show. And then I normally just do introductions and book differences, but I think I'm going to introduce a new feature this week, and that is notable departures.
Hmm.
You know, so we have the departure of Vardis Egan.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Who we've been introduced, you know, just briefly in a few chapters earlier. But he does a lot, this guy, to introduce us to Bronn, right? Because the more we learn about the contrast between Egan and Bronn, it's almost like Egan serves his purpose to introduce Bronn. And then Bronn, of course, emerges victorious. And we have a sense of him now as a character. He's sort of like a bizarro Vardis Egan. And now Steve and I cover Season 5, Episode 1, The Wars to Come. Cersei has a flashback to her childhood prophecy, Tywin is buried. Dany is trying to deal with her imprisoned dragons. And we have a budding interest between Missandei and Grey Worm. Finally, I ought to mention that Steve is back on stage after long last. So if you're interested in seeing Steve perform and you're in the North Bay, you can check out Ozfest at AUSFEST on Instagram. He usually posts about his gigs there. Without further ado, here's comic Steve Osborne. Steve, you've watched 41 episodes of Game of Thrones now. Did you know that?
Is that right?
Yeah, you have. So you know a lot about, I mean, there's still parts of the world that are not built yet, but for the most part, the canvas has been stretched.
Okay.
All right, so Steve, we are going to implement
Prima Nocta.
That never really works out well. You think it will?
Yeah.
It's not a good idea. Not a good idea. I know. I live in Ohio. We tried it for a little bit here.
All right. There's still some suburbs that practice it.
John Kasich gave it a go for a couple of years.
It's mostly just part of the HOAs.
All right, so we are instituting the Season 5 rule for this podcast.
Yeah.
And the Season 5 rule is that we're going to pick one thing that titillated us about the episode and one thing that didn't work for us. And, you know, we might keep this around for a while, but at least for Season 5, instead of just picking these episodes apart, we're just going to pick one of each. So we're going to ask you to go first. What's one thing about this episode that didn't work for you?
Well, this is a hard one, because on one hand, the easy answer is like, we're just getting an awful lot of Lord Baelish.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's...
That's funny. That's the thing that worked for me this episode.
Right, so funny. It's hard, because it's like, I mean, I do appreciate the sort of the insertion of him as like a little bit more of the baddie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I'm looking at something that like... just didn't work. Overall, the tone feels different. Season 5, the tone, it's at least coming out the gate. And maybe it's because of
where we
were.
Yeah, what is it? Was it pacing? Or what was it?
It's hard to say, but it just felt different. It felt like, I hate to say it, but it kind of felt like a show. More than it has in previous seasons.
rather than like a full feature film that happens to be episodic.
Yeah, right? Somehow it felt way more. It was almost like they did a special made for TV, like, you know, when like Saved by the Bell goes to Hawaii or something.
Right. Okay. Well, that's so. The overall tone was felt a little different.
Yeah, I mean, overall, as like, that's, I guess, what it is. I can't really put my finger on any one thing. I mean, there's things that I'm still like, I'm interested about the Marine thing. I guess I'm you know, the Danny meter, like we talk about the Brianna meter, the Danny meter is always sort of, it's always moving with me. It's never super steady. And I'm just not sure where I stand on this. I mean, I think that's I like the concept. I like the idea that she's struggling with leadership as opposed to just conquering and setting people free. And there's like all that. I like that, but there's something about the presentation that doesn't quite, I'm never as into those scenes as I feel like I should be compared to the other ones.
Something that didn't work for me was, I kind of like the Tyrion who I met in these first four seasons. And I'm not sure that depressed Tyrion is titillating me. And I realize that, you know, these characters can't stay one-dimensional. They have to be moving. I like to see a natural consequence to what it would be like to kill your own father. That's interesting to me.
Go on.
But, yeah. Like, it's really interesting to me.
Like, I could watch a whole show devoted what it's like after you kill your father.
Anyway, I don't know. I'm already a little bit tired of the nihilist Tyrion.
Really? That's quick.
Yeah, it really is.
See, and I think that I go maybe the other direction. I mean, I think from just a consumption standpoint, I want my old Tyrion back. But from a long-term view, the idea that he's endured so much and now he's just finally just sort of at this breaking point. And what do you do, right? And it's not like Jaime with one hand. Because Jaime can still cruise around and be Jaime, right? Like, people may murmur, like, I only got one hand. He's not as dangerous as he was. But he still looks like Jaime.
Yeah, maybe that's a good analogy here. Because I feel like when Jaime lost a hand, I thought, oh, shit. Like, what's going to happen to him now? And I'm kind of fascinated because I'd like to see his character on a different arc. But with Tyrion, I kind of felt like, I don't know if I'm willing to give up the old Tyrion yet.
It's almost like his character was killed off, but we still have to see his corpse dragged around.
Yeah, since this is a Weekend at Bernie's Tyrion. All right. Something that worked for you in this episode. Something that titillated.
I'm titillated by the Stannis Jon Snow dynamic.
Ooh, okay.
And it's interesting because the Wall usually is sort of also one of those ones that I'm like, I can take it or leave it. But I've become much more interested in Jon Snow, and I think a lot of me being interested in Jon Snow is when they introduced Ygritte to the situation. I think she helped flesh that character out a little bit, and I think that this has been a slow burn character arc that surprisingly has hooked into me. And it might be because, you know, we saw this very brief glimpse of this of like behind the curtain of the White Walkers. And so there's this other element out there. And so the Wall, I think, already has me a little bit, which is surprising because it's magic infused.
You know what? This is fascinating because I think you're right about John. And I think in order for him to get to where he is now, he had to kind of go through this hellish experience where now he's just holding his life kind of lightly.
Right.
Right. He's kind of like, I don't even care. I don't even care what happens to me. I'm going to do what I think is right. I think this whole thing is probably, there's probably a lot of bullshit baked into this whole institution. Whereas Tyrion is kind of at that stage. And for some reason, it makes Jon more interesting and makes Tyrion a little less interesting to me. But maybe, well, to your point, maybe I should be looking at Tyrion differently.
And I think that that's why I'm hanging on to the Tyrion thing, is because I've seen sort of a reciprocal relationship. I mean, we've seen Jon go from the bastard to maybe on his way to gets the name, but like we're seeing maybe Jon on that kind of arc, whereas Tyrion's become a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's like, what's he going to do with it? Is he going to rise out of it, or is he going to just drink himself to death in a box?
I'll tell you something. I'm beginning to really like the Littlefinger Sansa duo.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. I think, okay, number one, Sansa hated Joffrey for killing her father, right? She was never going to forgive him for killing her father, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now she's allied with the guy who killed her father.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Baelish was behind this whole thing.
Yeah.
And now she's allied with the guy that did that. So that's fascinating to me. But more than that, I feel like Sansa's finally taking an interest in politics. And not just like politics, but like figuring out how to manipulate people, figuring out how to effectively lie, figuring out. And what's happening is she's finally taking control of her own situation.
Right. Before, she kind of took control of things, but it was merely for survival, and it was kind of a haphazard. Would get her into, like, every time she would try to play the game, the way she was kind of thought, well, this is how you do it, it would get a little worse. And then it would get a little worse, and it would get a little worse. And now it's like, arguably, it's just as bad, or, you know, as it was. But she's like, okay, I can keep doing this, but to what end? I'm either going to be chased by inevitable death, or I can meet it head on and see if I can conquer it.
So in the same way that the Hound kind of taught Arya about killing people, right? I think that Baelish is teaching Sansa how to manipulate people. And these are both like really horrible, you know, murderous, evil mentors that they've taken. But it's almost like these guys are a means to survival for a particular, you know, time of their life. So I find that interesting. I like that. I like that a lot.
You like the dynamic enough to listen to Littlefinger talk.
Yeah, I will allow it.
That says a lot. A lot about that dynamic.
I also like to watch Robin Arryn try to spar. I just thought that was I could watch that all day long.
Yeah, because we haven't had a slappable young person in a while, so it's kind of nice.
Just to watch his little limp arm try to like barely hold up that wooden sword. All right. Hey, Steve, Loras has a tattoo that looks like a geographical region.
Yes, it does.
Steve, do you have a tattoo that looks like a geographical region?
I don't. I have a birthmark that looks like a smudge.
Well, you know what? I should have said birthmark. Loras has a birthmark that looks like Dorne, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre,
We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So you have a birthmark that looks like a smudge.
Yeah, it's not like no one's checking it out to see what it. I mean, I guess it could be. Probably looks like a district in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got a birthmark that looks a little bit like Wisconsin.
A district.
Okay.
It's been gerrymandered.
All right. Let's move on to
we're gonna close on gerrymander.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to keep with the theme of trial by combat. I was reading an essay by Peter Leeson on the Yale website. And he cites Russell in his 1983 publication, page 126. And here I quote the instructions for the plot of land to be used for a trial by battle. It must be an even and level piece of ground set square 60 feet on each side, due east, west, north, and south, and a place or seat for the justices of the bench was made without and above the lists, and covered with the furniture of the same bench in Westminster Hall, and a bar made there for the sergeant at law. I thought that was an interesting detail because the instructions for a trial by battle denote that it is an even plot of land, and I thought that was an interesting detail because, of course, Vardis and Braun fight on an uneven plot of land. And I thought, maybe Martin is playing with a metaphor about how uneven this battle actually is. Or maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into this. Again, such is the trouble with deep dives. Sometimes you see the things that you want to see, but at the same time, I would not put it past George Martin to further subvert the ideal. Finally, I found this paper by Pete Leeson fascinating, so I decided to interview him. That will be coming out shortly as a bonus episode, where Pete and I talk at length about Trial by Battle. Look for that as a bonus Boogaloo podcast in the near future. And that is all for this week.